In this particular session, winding up the materials of the Hebrew Scriptures or the Old Testament, we're going to wander back and forth through a good many centuries because we're going to be talking about sage and saint, the wisdom literature of the Bible, which represents a departure in very significant ways from the cultic patterns that have generally pervaded all of the previous materials with which we've been concerned. Wisdom as a way of life and literature is widely shared among peoples of the ancient Near East. Hebrew, or biblical wisdom literature, must be put into the context out of which it came, namely the Middle East in general. The very nature of wisdom literature is that it always tends to overlap national boundaries. Israel adopted wisdom techniques as a way of dealing with life and its problems, but eventually placed it within a pervasive theological context. It was, in the beginning, very like other Near Eastern thought, a way of adapting to reality. Later, it would be the Hebrew way of understanding God's way with the world. Thus, we have a linear development between Near Eastern wisdom, Mesopotamian wisdom, to Israel's wisdom, and finally to Israel's religion. Now, a brief historical overview. Sumer's classical period dated from about 2500 through 2400 before this common era. The Akkadian period, with the literature being written in Sumerian, dates from about 2300 to 2000 before this common era. Babylon dates from 1700 and shortly thereafter. Assyria from about 1300 before the common era. The Medes and the Chaldeans about 600, and after that, of course, Persia or Iran. And then the Hellenistic literature, due to the influence of Alexander the Great, particularly under the Seleucids, who primarily occupied the area we today call Syria, and the Ptolemies in Egypt, and then through the Maccabees themselves, who were Jewish participants in the struggle for a brief moment of freedom through which the Hebrew people went, or the Jewish people by this time went. Now, in Sumerian literature, you find all kinds of proverbial sayings. For example, these are taken from a period at least in the second millennium before this common era, and from Sumerian literature. As long as a man does not exert himself, he will gain nothing. Friendship lasts a day, kinship endures forever. I take it that's blood is thicker than water. A joyful heart, the bride, a sorrowful heart, the groom. I think this is an illustration of humorous male sexism of an earlier era. You go and carry off the enemy's land, the enemy comes and carries off your land. You can have a lord, you can have a king, but the man to fear is the tax collector. Now, all this dates from the second millennium before this common era, growing out of Sumerian proverbial or wisdom literature. A Sumerian essay on suffering and adversity, theodicy we call this, the attempt to justify the ways of God to humans. A Sumerian essay on suffering and adversity bearing a resemblance to Job goes as follows. Humans are helpless before the God's inscrutable will. Never has a sinless child been born to its mother. A sinless workman has not existed from of old. And of course, this must have been the Sumerian way of offering some kind of a reason for suffering. And then in Sumerian literature dating back so far, you find all kinds of fables. A cat for its thoughts, a mongoose for its action, the donkey eats its own bedding. Well, this is the kind of literature that helps human beings understand their life together and how to cope with that life. Wisdom literature has very much to do with the whole idea of how to cope. When we move on to the Babylonian literature, we pick up the very same kind of themes. For example, the pig is not fit for a temple, lacks sense, is not allowed to tread on pavements, and an abomination to all the gods. The fowler who had no fish but had caught birds, holding his bird net, he jumped into the city moat. If you think that through, I think this means this man couldn't adjust to change. Or here, when you exert yourself, your God is yours. When you do not exert yourself, your God is not yours. I think that means success comes to those who help themselves. Or do not frequent a law court and do not loiter where there is a dispute. I think the whole nation might have listened to that very ancient bit of wisdom during the O.J. Simpson trial. Do not utter solemn oaths while alone. I think the modern version of this is, walls have ears. Well, all of these wisdom sayings have reflections through the centuries in other kinds of literature because wisdom thought jumps national boundaries. Egyptian literature, which has had a profound influence upon Hebrew literature, in fact, one whole portion of the Proverbs in the Hebrew scriptures is taken word for word from a great old Egyptian wisdom poem. But listen to some of these from Egypt. Let not thy heart be puffed up because of thy knowledge. Be not confident because thou art a wise man. Take counsel with the ignorant as well as the wise. And I take this to mean humility is a virtue. Copy thy fathers and thy ancestors. Behold, their words remain in writing. Open that thou mayest read and copy their wisdom. Thus the skilled man becomes learned. This is the way to success, to imitate your ancestors in their understanding. Margaret Mead wrote a book shortly before her death in which she pointed out there are three kinds of societies, a post-figurative society, a co-figurative society, and a prefigurative society. Post-figurative societies learn from the past. This accounts for much wisdom literature. Co-figure societies learn from their peers. Thus, a child whose parents comes from a foreign country and he settles here in this country or she settles in this country as an immigrant tends not to imitate the wisdom of his or her parents, but that of his or her peer group, learns to dress like other teenagers dress, talk like they talk, develop the language skills, and so forth. And a prefigurative culture is one that learns from the future. Presumably, that's what we're supposed to be doing today in terms of our wisdom literature, getting some grasp of the direction of history, what the future is likely to be about, and grab hold of it in a meaningful way. Well, wisdom literature wraps around all three of these kind of societies. Amen M. Opet, for example, a great Egyptian wisdom thinker, his words were literally lifted out of the wisdom origins and placed right in the middle of the Proverbs, as mentioned a moment ago. Proverbs 22 through 24 is practically in its entirety a passage drawn from this particular Egyptian wise man. Now, some general information about wisdom literature. Wisdom literature is largely poetic in literary form. Of course, approximately one-third of all the Hebrew scriptures is poetry. Secondly, most wisdom literature is grounded more in human experience than in what is often called by the religious divine revelation. Formal institutional religion, even Israel's unique historical experience, play very little part until the late literature in the Apocrypha and Sirach and the Wisdom of Solomon. These are part of the Apocrypha in the Roman Catholic Bible and increasingly being printed in Protestant Bibles. Third, court wisdom and court sages were very like modern bureaucrats. They were mostly in training for government service. They wanted wise men running the government. They were therefore products of and at the service of the state. Most of their literature has passed from history into oblivion. Fourth, much wisdom literature is borrowed from surrounding cultures and hence has a much more universal application than one that could be called either provincial or parochial. Fifth, the sage, that is the wisdom person, the sage was primarily focused upon life as it is, often more interested in questions than in answers, and generally concerned quite simply with how to cope. Sixth, by way of general information, for Jews, the struggle with theodicy, justifying God's ways to humans, particularly in the face of suffering and difficulty, was always a task that they found almost insurmountable. Consequent upon this was the very deep sense of guilt that is woven into a system that must shift responsibility wholly to humans. And in that, of course, we get the great writing of Job. Now, I hope you have in your possession a document called Two Kinds of Biblical Theology. Because as we deal with the wisdom literature, we need to ask a few questions. For example, when did it begin? we are reasonably certain that wisdom literature for the Hebrews, or therefore for the biblical tradition, began in the time of Solomon. This is likely why Solomon is called wise, though many of the things he did were very unwise. It is also why his name is attached to certain literature, both in the canonical scriptures and in extra-canonical materials. When Saul took the throne, he was a tribal leader. When David followed him, he moved out into broader circles. But Solomon really was the first king of a nation rather than a group of tribes. And Solomon reached out in agreements and compacts and covenants with other countries. We are told he married 500 wives. That seems to be a rather mythological figure. But notwithstanding, he did marry many foreign women, quite obviously, and brought with them their religious traditions, which angered many Hebrews at the time, and similarly brought with them patterns of thought that today we would call those of wisdom literature. Therefore, when the Bible was finally put together, the Hebrew scriptures, that is, was finally put together in the form we now have it, you end up with two startlingly differing kinds of biblical theology. The one I would generally call cultic theology, and in using the word cult, as I believe I suggested in an earlier session, I do not use it in a pejorative or critical way. I simply mean that grouping of beliefs, that system of operation, the structure in terms of organization and personnel that constitutes the way that theology or religion expresses itself. And then there's wisdom theology, which is quite a different thing. And if you can follow this particular chart, two kinds of biblical theology, we've tried to separate them, clearly understanding how they speak a different message. In cultic theology, the emphasis is largely on history. In wisdom theology, the emphasis is largely on nature. In cultic theology, creation is portrayed as disordered. You know, the Garden of Eden story. In wisdom theology, creation is pictured as orderly. In cultic theology, humans are portrayed as above creation, while in wisdom theology, humans are within creation. In cultic theology, God therefore intervenes in creation, while in wisdom theology, God works through creation. Death in cultic theology is historical as a result of sin. In wisdom theology, death is simply natural. Everything dies. All things must be born anew. In cultic theology, the authority is presumably by revelation, while in wisdom theology, authority is by experience. The emphasis, therefore, in cultic theology is how to belong to the religious group, or as often expressed in biblical terms, how to be saved. While in wisdom theology, the emphasis is how to live. In consequence of this, cultic theology produces an ethic of law, while wisdom theology produces an ethic of relationships. Cultic theology, therefore, engages in punishment for sin and guilt, while wisdom theology tends to suggest that you learn by trial and error. Cultic theology, therefore, produces two worlds, the secular and the sacral, or sacred, while in wisdom theology, the secular is sacred. That is, all things are holy. In cultic theology, you then tend to end up with an hierarchical and theocentric system, while in wisdom theology, it tends much more to be democratic and anthropocentric. Therefore, the final word is that in terms of the presence of the divine, incarnation, the presence of the divine in human experience, is in cultic theology always intrusive, while in wisdom theology, incarnation is intrinsic. If you put this into Christian terms, you would say in cultic theology, God sent Jesus. If you were to put it in the language of wisdom theology, you would say God raised up Jesus from our own midst. Within the biblical narrative, the canonical wisdom literature includes Proverbs, Job, Ecclesiastes, the Song of Solomon, scattered portion of the Psalms, and a few other scattered portions within Hebrew scriptures. There are a couple of apocryphal books that are obviously wisdom literature, the Wisdom of Ben Sira or Sirach, and the Wisdom of Solomon. Now, to go through these books one by one and explore a little bit what they're about and what they have to say is also to discover not only that wisdom literature is a counter-prevailing view to that of cultic literature, but one may go back even further and suggest that as the Bible in general is a book written from the viewpoint of the loser, that is to say, it's an alternative view of history to that of the great winners like Assyria and Babylon and Persia, Greece, Rome. As the Bible in general is an alternative view of history, so wisdom literature is an alternative view of the cultic literature within the Bible. And you get an alternative way of understanding reality and an alternative form of expressing theology. To begin with, the book of Proverbs. Who wrote Proverbs? Well, apparently a lot of people wrote Proverbs because they're drawn from all over the Middle East, although many of them are obviously explicitly Hebrew. And Solomon's name is attached to these, and the likelihood, from an historical point of view, is that Solomon himself did begin the collection of a series of wisdom sayings that eventually get added to, conflated, and so forth, and become what we call the Book of Proverbs. We know approximately how to date various parts of Proverbs. For example, the first 9 chapters come from about 250 before this common era and colorfully personify wisdom as a woman and even gives a picture of this woman, this wisdom presence, being with God in creation. You almost have here something beyond monotheism in a dualism of deity, with wisdom on the one hand and God the Creator on the other hand, though one must not press that point too hard. Nonetheless, the first 9 chapters approximately of the Proverbs is a personification of wisdom as a female figure. The 10th chapter through the 22nd, or part of the 22nd, was probably written 500 or 600 years earlier than the first 9 chapters, probably around 700 before this common era, in which there are 375 sayings, the exact numerical equivalent in the Hebrew of the word Solomon. Beginning with the latter part of the 22nd chapter, verse 17, through the 24th chapter, 34th verse, we have here this great poem of wisdom literature from Egyptian sources by Amen M. Ope, from about the year 600 before this common era. The 25th through the 29th chapters are written after the exile. The 30th chapter, part of it is Arabian in origin without any question. Another part is sort of beyond identification. The 31st chapter is similarly Arabic of very late origin. And the 31st chapter is a colorful poem about a virtuous woman described at least in terms of the kind of virtues women were supposed to have had in that particular period. So here we have the Proverbs drawn from all kinds of sources over many, many centuries. What is a proverb? Well, proverb, mashal, means a likeness or a comparison. The book of Proverbs is really optimistic. It is based upon the notion that the world is reliable, and in this sense, the book of Proverbs is largely anti-ascetic, humanistic, and very this-worldly. Also, moderation in the book of Proverbs is really celebrated as the key to successful living. The virtues in the book of Proverbs, with very few exceptions, the virtues are mostly passive, with little or no social passion. It can be said then to be mostly conservative in mood, with an underlying notion to live well, don't meddle. The appeal is generally, therefore, to enlightened self-interest. It does, however, celebrate personal integrity and individual responsibility. Finally, there's very little speculative interest in the book of Proverbs. Walk, not talk. Be in harmony with reality. Don't go against the grain. Don't raise too many questions. Accept reality as it is and shape it to meaningful forms for your own good ends. There's an Arabian proverb that is sliced into another pattern in the book of Proverbs that goes, if the father be an onion and the mother a garlic, how can the child have a sweet perfume? Well, the book of Proverbs is filled with these kind of statements, but represents a conservative, don't meddle kind of philosophy. By now that it ought to be fundamentally clear that that is awesomely in contrast, let us say, to the great literary prophets of the 8th, 7th, and 6th century before the Common Era, like Isaiah, Amos, Micah, Hosea, who very much chose to meddle. They would not in any way have acknowledged the satisfactory meaningfulness of the book of Proverbs. We come to the book of Ecclesiastes. It probably dates from about the 3rd century before this common era. We assume that because in the book of Ecclesiastes we find numerous Persian or Iranian words. They would not have been introduced into Hebrew language forms earlier than that because the Hebrews had not contacted or come in contact with the Persian before that period. It really is in some ways, if you think in the main of the Bible, in broad strokes, it's the strangest book to be found in the Bible. The strangest. For example, in the language of Ecclesiastes, God does not reveal himself anywhere, nor can God be known. Secondly, it is rationalistic, agnostic, skeptical, profoundly pessimistic, fatal or fatalistic, and existential. Very unlike the cultic literature in the biblical narrative. The author was probably a cultivated, educated, sophisticated civil servant in government, now retired, and pondering his long life and his service to the state. There is in Ecclesiastes no cultic interest whatsoever. There is no Yahweh, the name, the holy name for the God of the Hebrews. When the name of God appears, it is only that of El or Elohim, which is the generic form of God to be found all throughout the Middle East. Now, the general point of view runs this way, as already mentioned. You cannot discover God. You cannot discover God's purpose in the world. The only thing you can discover is how things are. And how things are really makes no sense. Therefore, a human's chief good is to relish being alive in moderation and reserve, or at least don't get caught. All life, in the view of Ecclesiastes, is cyclical. This is in profound contradiction to the cultic memories of the Hebrew peoples who saw history as having a beginning and an end, having a creation and having a consummation. Ecclesiastes doesn't see it that way. Ecclesiastes sees it as a farmer would the changing of the seasons, spring planting, summer growth, fall harvest, winter death, spring planting, summer growth, fall harvest, winter death, and so forth. All life is cyclical, going nowhere. History has no meaning because there is nothing new under the sun, to use a phrase typical of Ecclesiastes. Similarly, rather interestingly, for a book within the Bible, which is another reason why it's the strangest book there, there is no sense of sin, only appropriate behavior and inappropriate behavior, behavior that works and behavior that doesn't work at all. And, of course, all life is canceled by death. Let me read just a brief passage or two from Ecclesiastes. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death is greater and better than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of everyone, and the living ought to lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of countenance the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fools is in the house of mirth. There goes Hollywood. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression makes the wise foolish, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. The patient in spirit are better than the proud in spirit. Do not be quick to anger, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. Do not say, why were the former days better than these? There is nothing new under the sun. Well, what kind of values do we find from Ecclesiastes? So much at odds with cultic Hebrew religion, even at odds with the book of Proverbs, because Proverbs is essentially optimistic. You can find out how the world works, and you can go with the flow. Not Ecclesiastes. I think the values might be summed up something like this, and there is something to be said for Ecclesiastes. First, a person ought to face the fact of life, ought to face the facts of his or her life, and ought to face them fearlessly. Maurice Freeman once said, who is more foolish, the child afraid of the dark or the man afraid of the light? That's the first value of Ecclesiastes. The second is, learn to live with what cannot be changed. Make the best of it. Find enjoyment in your work and wisdom in it, and don't fret. The third great value, I think, that one might find from this strange book of Ecclesiastes, the goal of life is simply the living of it. And I think back to Ralph Waldo Emerson, who once wrote, the reward for a thing well done is simply to have done it. That's Ecclesiastes. And finally, the fourth virtue of Ecclesiastes would be, don't be smug. And that's not a bad virtue for most people. If I were to sum up Ecclesiastes in simple terms, and some might say, believe it or not, I would do so by quoting a prayer written by Reinhold Niebuhr. Reinhold Niebuhr was probably the most celebrated theologian of this century in America. And the head of Alcoholics Anonymous came to Reinhold Niebuhr in New York and asked him to write a prayer that they might use for the Alcoholics Anonymous movement. And Reinhold Niebuhr did, and most everyone knows it. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. That's Ecclesiastes. Now, Job is an extraordinary document. It's extraordinary because it runs against the grain. It not only runs against the grain of theology in the cultic tradition, it runs against the grain of common perceptions at the time this author wrote the book, and it does so in powerful language that calls into question God himself or herself, calls into question the divine. Job is about theodicy. Theodicies, that is, the attempt to understand why people suffer, why there's tragedy, why there's heartache, why perhaps there's death. Theodicy is the attempt to understand why life is as it is, but in theological terms, it means trying to assert meaningfully the ways of God to man, trying to discover or to defend or to explain God to humans. Theodicies fall into three basic categories. One of them is this: God is omnipotent and omnibenevolent. That is, he's all-powerful and all-good. In this view, you got a problem. Either evil is simply an illusion, or it exists but is not really genuine, since from an ultimate frame of reference, every evil turns out in one way or another for the best of all in a realistically possible world. All suffering, therefore, is interim and does not violate the goodness of God nor the powerfulness of God. I suppose if one were to take this position, God as omnipotent and omnibenevolent, he would have to say that all evil is purposeful and therefore isn't that grand. But when you're going through evil, it doesn't seem that way at all. And of course, many a Jew in our time has tried to take the meanings of the Holocaust into account as over against the language of Job. In many ways, this particular theodicy, God is all-powerful and all-good, would suggest that evil as a problem is simply positional. That is, if you're a carrot and a rabbit comes along, it's evil for you. But if you're a rabbit and a man comes along, it's evil for the rabbit. In other words, evil is basically positional. Earthquake experts say as much. They say there's no problem with earthquakes, just don't build your houses over the San Andreas Fault. But of course, people still do. That's one theodicy. The second basic category for a theodicy says that God is omnipotent but not omnibenevolent. That is, he's all-powerful, but he's not all-good. God simply will not prevent those evils that occur due to human freedom. He won't intervene. He won't take human side. Creation, once set on its way, and this often is the position of deism, the watchmaker view of God, where God winds up the universe and then lets it go its way. God, creation, once set on its way, is self-generating, self-sustaining, and involves freedom. That is, as the biblical narrative says in the cultic literature, God gave humans dominion over earth, which means they have taken the place of God and are in charge within the created order. So what you have in this view is generally an understanding of God as once all-powerful, having relinquished that by giving freedom, and therefore, in a sense, cannot be really described as all-good, who allows such a thing as the Holocaust to occur. And the third theodicy, basic view of explaining God to humans and explaining the meaning of suffering in life, is that God is omnibenevolent, but not omnipotent. That is, God is all good, all loving, but not all powerful. And this particular theodicy would put it this way. God can do absolutely nothing contrary to his own nature. I remember my first course in graduate school in theology, we had to wrestle for a week with the question, can God create a rock so big that not even God can move it? And no matter how you answer the question, if it is answerable, God ceases to be omnipotent. But God cannot, in that context, necessarily be defined as not omnibenevolent. God is the greatest conceivable being, but is incapable of unilaterally preventing all evil occurrences if God chooses freedom for his creation as one of its primary gifts. Well, here are these three views of theodicy. Now, when we get to Job, we're dealing with a man who was born into a world that said, if you're a good guy, good things will happen to you. If you're a bad guy, you will get clobbered. Quite simply that. And this is a story about a very, very good man who got treated very, very badly. From the third chapter through the 42nd, the sixth verse, it's all poetry, and that probably is the entirety of the book of Job from the original author. Later on, somebody came along and added a prose portion at the beginning and a brief prose portion at the end in order to make the incredible, unorthodox thoughts of Job palatable because it had become such a powerful wisdom document in the life of the Hebrew people. But if you remove the prologue and the epilogue and read just the poetry, you really are grasped by the power of this particular book. The book of Job clearly is a protest against the long-standing view that in this life righteousness always results in prosperity and wickedness always results in misfortune. But Satan, or Satan, one of God's ministering spirits, a sort of advocatus diaboli, as he would be called in the Roman Catholic Church, for when they are about to think about canonizing some person, bringing some person to sainthood, the Pope is always required to appoint a brilliant scholar to be the advocatus diaboli and find every reason possible why this person should not be a saint. That is a positive service to the church, or so it is said. And therefore, Satan in Job is an adversary on God's behalf, a kind of prosecuting attorney. And Satan's point of view is very simple. He insists there is no such thing as disinterested religion. Everybody expects to get something. Everybody expects something for being good and godly. And so God says, no, I know a man for whom religion is a disinterested commitment of love and caring. and Satan says rubbish. That is, so to speak, he says rubbish. And so the contest in heaven is set in motion, but it's played out on earth. And so all of the great gifts that Job has created out of his life are stripped from him. His wife, his children, the animals, his great ranch or farm or properties, everything is stripped from him. All he has left are his friends who come to comfort and stay to vilify, because one and all they're orthodox and they can't understand any new pattern of thinking. His friends come to comfort, they stay to vilify. And there are three of them, and they represent, obviously, in symbolic form, something for the author of Job. Eliphaz, the first of his friends, is the oldest. He's wise, he's pious, and he's profoundly loyal to orthodox explanations for everything. He can't understand how it's possible for Job to be good and be suffering as well. So he has to reject Job's goodness. He comes to comfort. He stays to vilify. Bildad, the second of his friends, this is all he has left. And he's now even beginning to have boils on his body and stomach ulcers and all kinds of things happening to him, as well as all these dreadful losses in life. Bildad comes. Bildad is the scholar, loyal to tradition, a bibliolater. He worships the tradition. He worships the tradition much more than he does God. And therefore, he can't understand a tradition that has said, do good, good results, do bad, lousy results. And so he too comes to comfort, stays to vilify. And finally, there's Zophar. Well, he's the man in the street. He's the man in the street, dogmatic, rigid, unbending, no real knowledge. He is, in modern terms, and I hope you all know of whom I'm speaking, Archie Bunker. Zophar is Archie Bunker, and he too cannot possibly understand the perambulations of thought through which this strange man Job is going. Now, what's true of each of these three is that each of these friends deals alike with a new situation in an old way and cannot adapt to change, to any kind of change, a change in environment, a change in information, a change that would be brought about by new ideas. Well, Job himself struggles with all this, raises his voice against God, raises his voice against his friends, and of all things, I'll never know how the phrase, the patience of Job, ever clambered into the vocabulary. Job is not patient, but he is faithful, and he is altogether honest. He is passionately honest and will not call black white or white black. And in his honesty, his extreme honesty, he ends up a lonely man. Once having known God, however, he cannot deny God in adversity. Strange thing that. He will not confess to sins that simply are not his. His inherited theology says, God is unjust in this situation, therefore. But he can't quite say that. His earlier experience says, God is good. And so he asks himself, how shall I reconcile these two great experiences that have become terrible in retrospect? Listen to the words of Job in one passage. This is from the third chapter. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Job said, let the day perish in which I was born, and the night that said, a male child is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, or light shine on it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds settle upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Yes, let that night be barren. And let no joyful cry be heard. Let those curse it who curse the sea, those who are skilled to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none. May it not see the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb and hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire? Why were there knees to receive me or breasts for me to suck? Now I would be lying down and quiet. I would be asleep. Then I would be at rest with kings and counselors of the earth, who rebuild ruins for themselves, or with princes who have gold, who fill their houses with silver. Or why was I not buried like a stillborn child, like an infant that never sees the light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They do not any longer hear the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slaves are at last free from their masters. Well, here's a man suffering mightily, and suffering precisely because he can't put two ideas together, the goodness of God and his own suffering, given the theology of his people that has said time and time again, do good, you'll have good, do evil, you'll have evil. Thus, the book of Job. I think many times when I think of the book of Job, that what we're dealing with here, of course, is obviously the character of God. Job is struggling with the character of God, and that's why we speak of theodicy as an attempt to explain God to humans. But the conclusion that Job finally comes to is that he has no answers, or no answer to his penetrating question of why, but he still has a sense of the presence of God. Mine eyes still may not see the answer, but my eye sees God. And I many times think of Job when I think of a saying that I've long felt represents good wisdom literature. Expecting the world to treat you fairly because you are a good person is a little like expecting the bull not to attack you because you are a vegetarian. The Song of Songs is a remarkable document. All of these documents are quite remarkable, and of course, the key or clue to this whole course is read the Bible yourself. Read all these great passages yourself in detail, for which there is no time in these brief sessions. But there's no composition of comparable size to that of the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon that has provoked such an extraordinary amount of commentary and literature. In a set of commentaries on all the books of the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, the Song of Solomon, with a handful of chapters, is about 4 inches thick on my library shelf. Hundreds of pages, 1,000 or more, to explain these very few chapters. Why has this been? Well, it is because every person that has seen this within a holy atmosphere, that is within the Bible, within the Holy Bible, within the Scriptures, has had difficulty explaining a book that is so plainly erotic in content. Practically all of those who have commented on the Song of Solomon until very modern times tried to evade its plain message by psychological or theological aversion. They have run from the plain sense of the song. Mostly, therefore, the Song of Solomon has been allegorized, and I did refer to this in an earlier one of our sessions. It's been allegorized amongst the Hebrews as God's love for his people Israel, his chosen people, and allegorized in the Christian church as the love of Jesus for his church. I am inclined to think no book in the Bible more accurately represents a point of view that we suggested early in these sessions, that the most important thing to remember about reading the Bible, if you want to interpret it honestly and fairly and honorably, is this. Don't ask, first of all, what does the Bible say, but ask, first of all, what did it say? What did it say for those people for whom it was first written, or who first heard it, or first read it? And then once you've discovered what it said to them, maybe you can understand or extrapolate into modern times how it can speak more powerfully to you. It was not written, the Song of Solomon, much later than the 5th or 4th century. There are words there that would suggest this. Therefore, it could not have been written by Solomon. It's a love poem, highly erotic, with the images drawn from shared Mideastern thought forms and with some obvious pagan sources. As I've already suggested, Christians and Jews have tried to explain the plain sense of the song away. But from my point of view, if Scripture has been concerned in its gathering from many sources and over a period of 1,000 years and more, if Scripture has been concerned about all that is human, then it deserves a place in the canon of sacred literature. The deep and abiding truth of the Song of Songs is in one of its own expressions. Love is stronger than death. Love is the only power that can cope with death. God has created a world that is a life-giving process. Life has no meaning apart from a God who is love. And generally, it's interesting to note that biblical materials often speak of God as righteous, but not as righteousness. Of God as just, but not of God as justice. Of God as good, but not God as goodness. But commonly, throughout the biblical tradition, it does not speak of God as loving, but of God as love. And the Song of Solomon, I think, finds that meaning in the remarkable relationship between a man and a woman, even in the most erotic embraces, which can be described as they are in this book. Lamentations, the five poems in this book, corresponding to the five chapters, present a mix of literary types. There are funeral dirges in which a dead Jerusalem is mourned. Therefore, we're dealing with a book, Lamentations, that has to do with the fall of Jerusalem and the beginnings of the Babylonian captivity. It also has individual laments, and it has community laments. And the book is properly called Lamentations. The poems reflect obviously at close range the events and conditions of the fall of Jerusalem in 587. The poetry is likely the direct product of one or more eyewitnesses to these events. It therefore is probably properly dated about 587, or somewhere between there and 540 before this common era. It has some remarkable poetry in it, beautiful funeral dirges. Its value, I suppose, for us is that it contemplates the stark consequences of having made terrible choices and having made poor decisions, or in the language of cultic theology, of human sin and misery. Secondly, it does not suspend belief at any time in God's ultimate goodness, as, for example, Ecclesiastes does. It can even contemplate a bright future in the midst of its deep mourning over the desecration that has occurred in Jerusalem. Jewish people over the centuries have used Lamentations to describe their situation in being away from their land, being in diaspora Judaism, Judaism dispersed throughout the world, but not in Jerusalem. Of course, today they are in Jerusalem, but Lamentations certainly has spoken over the centuries to the Jewish mind away from his or her homeland. Now, one more book it's important to discuss before we wrap up the Hebrew Scriptures or the Old Testament and go to the New Testament. And that, of course, is the hymn book of the Hebrew people, the Psalms. As I remember from childhood days, I was told all you have to do is take your Bible, sit it on a table, split it open in the middle, and there you'll find the Psalms, right in the middle of the book. And that's generally true. As some have said, the Psalms are really a Bible in miniature, a manual of wonderful and aesthetic brevity and beauty. Psalms means songs, and this word is derived from the Septuagint, or the Greek version of the Hebrew Scriptures. There are 150 psalms in the book of Psalms, arranged in five books. Now, very often, in the aftermath of the use of the Torah, you will find divisions of five in Scripture, and generally this represents, guess what? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, or the Torah itself. And so there are 150 psalms arranged in five books, in my opinion, reflecting the Torah. Later on, as we come into the New Testament and the Christian scriptures, we'll find that, for example, the Gospel of Matthew has the Sermon on the Mount, which is divided into exactly five divisions, beginning with Jesus pronouncing the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes are a counterpart for the Ten Commandments, and the five sections to the Sermon on the Mount are obviously a counterpart to Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And that's also what you find right here in the Psalms. This is a reminder that as the literature of the Bible began to unfold, each new person writing in some way or another referred to times past, referred to other experiences, and picked up the themes and the ideas that had been passed down to him or her as their inheritance. Whoever put the Psalms together, that is, whoever was the redactor or the editor, must have made a few mistakes unless he simply was a man or a person who desired extraordinary and unusual emphasis, because some psalms appear twice. The 14th psalm is exactly reproduced as the 53rd psalm. Psalm 40, 13 through 17 is the 70th psalm also. Psalm 57, verses 7 through 11, plus 60, 5 through 12, is the 108th psalm. Well, this tells us something else about redaction, or about the way the biblical materials over the years were edited. It would suggest that the author of the Psalms brought together all these hymns and that he began to put them together and did not notice that from time to time he got two Psalms, because he must have liked them well, put one early and then another considerably later, and didn't have a second redactor to go over his work after he had completed it. It obviously, though, suggests a compilation and not a single person writing the Psalms. Many of the Psalms are identified as being written by one person or another. How accurate are these identifications? Well, some of them may be accurate. Most scholars feel that some of them are accurate, some of them are guesses, and some of them are deliberate attempts to attach the name of some very important person to a psalm that someone had written that he wanted on board. Many times in reading the Psalms, you'll run across the word Selah, S-E-L-A-H, in the English transliteration. We don't have any idea really what this means. We have nothing in ancient literature that will give us a final clue that would allow anything like certainty in understanding this in reading the Psalms. But many scholars have decided it probably means musical interlude. And that's as good a guess as any. The Psalms were largely composed for use in worship, although curiously, most persons over the centuries have used the Psalms in very personal ways and not inappropriately. There are within the compass of the 150 Psalms hymns, real hymns that you sing, laments, and there are magnificent songs of thanksgiving. As already suggested, this is a book of multiple authorship. 73 of the Psalms are deliberately attributed to David. Did he write them all? Well, he may have written some. It seems unlikely that he wrote that many, or that they would have been remembered in this particular way, but it's possible. Some are attributed to other individuals, a few to Moses, some to Solomon. Some clearly reflect the destruction of Jerusalem, so we know these Psalms were written very late in the history of the Hebrew peoples. And some are adaptations of earlier texts from pagan sources. The 19th Psalm, verses 1 through 6, for example, is a Canaanite hymn to the sun. The 29th chapter is similarly a Canaanite hymn to the storm god Baal. And the 104th Psalm is the Canaanite version of an Egyptian sun hymn to Amenhotep IV. Or Akhenaten, or Ikhenaten, or however you pronounce that word, since it's pronounced many different ways by many different people. It's interesting to note that a group called the Essenes, who produced the Dead Sea Scrolls that have been so popular and so widely publicized in the last 30 or 40 years, the Essenes were marvelously adept at writing Psalms themselves and wrote many, and they're beautiful. But the Psalms are largely cultic. They largely recommend obeying the law. they suggest dire consequences otherwise. Therefore, the Psalms cannot really be placed in the category of wisdom literature. Let me just read a couple of the Psalms with which you may already be familiar. For example, Psalm 8. O Lord, our Sovereign, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You've set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouths of babes and infants, you have founded a bulwark because of your foes to silence the enemy and the avenger. So that when I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have established, what are human beings that you are mindful of them, mortals that you care for them, and yet you have made them a little lower than God. Crown them with glory and honor. You've given them dominion over the works of your hands. You've put all things under their feet, the sheep and the oxen and the beasts of the field, the birds of the air and the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the sea. O Lord, our Sovereign, how majestic is your name in all the earth. The 13th Psalm. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I bear pain in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all day long? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O Lord God. Answer me. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep the sleep of death, and my enemy will say, I've prevailed. My foes will rejoice because I am shaken. But I trusted in your steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord. Answer me, therefore, because you have dealt bountifully with me. That's a lament. Psalm 22, 1 through 11. Some say this is the source of a cry attributed to Jesus on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me, from the words of my groaning? Oh, my God, I cry by day, but you don't answer, and by night, but I find no rest. Yet I know you're holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. In you our ancestors trusted, they trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried, and they were saved. In you they trusted, and they were not put to shame. But I'm a worm. I'm not hardly human. Scorned by others, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They shake their heads and say, commit your cause to the Lord. Let him deliver you. And so the psalm goes on speaking of death. It sounds very like a Jobian character has written that psalm. Psalm 121 is one of the most misunderstood psalms in the way it's used, or at least in my experience it is. It's a psalm obviously dealing with the fact that being down in the valley, up on the hillside, was the enemy looking down on the Hebrew peoples. And this author writes, I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where is my help going to come from? My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. He who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time on and forevermore.